Good morning, this is Jeff Blankfort, welcoming you to the June 3rd edition of Takes on the World, public affairs programs that come your way the second and fourth Wednesdays of every month. Andrew Coburn is the Washington editor of Harper's Magazine and author of many articles and books on national security, among them, The Threat in 1983, which exposed the myth of Soviet military superiority that fueled the Cold War, Dangerous Liaison, the inside story of the U.S.-Israeli covert relationship, co-authored with his wife Leslie in 1991, Out of the Ashes, the Resurrection of Saddam Hussein in 1999, and the New York Times Editor's Choice, Rumsfeld, in 2007. Again, his latest book is called Kill Chain. James Banford, noted historian of the NSA, has written, quote, "Rather than voter IDs, people should prove they have read this book before being allowed to vote in the next election," end quote. Pretty heavy words, but if you read Kill Chain, you'll understand what James Banford meant. Now, let's welcome to the KZWX airwaves, Andrew Coburn. Let's begin by defining what is meant by the term kill chain for those of our audience who haven't heard it.
Well, that's no surprise because it's a technical military term usually used in the Air Force. And it really means the process you go through or they go through from, you know, deciding to hit some target to all the things they have to do in the meantime, you know, sort of rounding up the weapons, fixing the target in their sights or their sensors, launching the missile or bomb or whatever it happens to be, and then hopefully from their point of view, destroying it.
You talk about the change in the nature of warfare, what they call the revolution of military affairs. Describe that in general terms before we get into specifics.
Well, that was their term, not mine, and I'm pretty rude about it in the book. What it was a presumption that now weapons were so incredibly accurate and precise that this had changed everything, and you could now be absolutely guaranteed that when you aimed at something with the new weapons, precision-guided missiles and things like that, that you were going to hit them, and therefore this meant you could be incredibly precise and know exactly what was going to happen, that you could, it was more beyond just precision of weapons, that you could have total information. You could know everything you needed to know about the enemy. You could actually hit any part of the enemy that you chose to and be able to predict what the effect would be. I mean, it sounds completely lunatic, which it was. But the real point was this is all very expensive. And really, as I argue in the book, I hope convincingly, that this was really what really fundamentally drove this was the ever-present sort of greed and motivation for make ever larger profits by the military-industrial complex. So that was really what that's kind of a long-winded answer, but that's what the so-called revolution in military affairs was and is.
And you showed that it didn't work as they planned, but they ignored that fact.
Well, right, because in one way it did work because it generated them absolute billions and billions, trillions of dollars. But it certainly didn't work as advertised because, for a start, you never can know, and they certainly didn't know, as recent wars have convincingly demonstrated, they didn't know everything they needed to know about the enemy. And as it turned out, their weapons aren't so precise, and they. Really, I point out that the, for instance, with drones, that what they show you in movies, in their sort of propaganda movies like Zero Dark Thirty, they show drones being able to see with absolute clarity what's going on underneath. But that's not the case. In fact, I found out, and I talk about this in the book, give an example of how none of this so-called revolution in military affairs and, lives up to what they advertise, in that they, the drones, they say the drones have, 20/20 vision, and that's what you see in, propaganda movies like Zero Dark Thirty and so forth. But in fact, I found out that half the time they have 20/200 vision, which is actually the legal definition of blindness or drivers in this country. So we're killing, think about it, we're actually targeting people, you know, that we can't really see. They're just sort of blurry images, you know, sort of Mr. Magoo-type images, you know, with this supposedly revolutionary technology.
And you illustrate that in your book. Actually, most people aren't aware of it, but all this technology goes back to the war in Vietnam and to a group called the Jasons, which most of our listeners, including I, had never heard of, but there were some familiar characters from the Manhattan Project. Perhaps you could talk about that and what they plotted.
Right. It was so I talk about this early in the book. The whole idea of remote warfare and being able to sort of do it all, you know, at a distance, really found its first big expression in the Vietnam War when this group, the Jasons, and they were a group of eggheads, mostly physicists, most of whom had worked on the Manhattan Project. And they liked to get together. They would get together and discuss sort of big defense problems and give their findings to the Secretary of Defense, or would be asked by him. So, it came to pass that the Vietnam War wasn't going so well, and one of the reasons that was deduced why it wasn't going well was the North Vietnamese could resupply the forces fighting in the south down the Ho Chi Minh Trail, which, you know, went through Laos and so forth. Most people have heard of that. So the Jasons were commissioned to come up with an answer, and what they said was, what we suggest is that you plant sensors all over the jungle where the Ho Chi Minh Trail runs, you know, invisibly through the trees, under the trees, and they will, every time a Vietnamese walks or North Vietnamese walks or drives past, the sensors will either send the sound he's making or the sort of impact he makes walking on the ground. It sounds incredible, it's true. Or even every time he takes a piss, the smell of the ammonia in his urine, that will also be, you know, detected. And all these signals will be radioed back to a giant computer in Thailand, and thus we'll be able to plot North Vietnamese supply columns and go and destroy them. And so this went ahead. Secretary McNamara loved the idea, and they spent $6 to $7 billion, which is probably at least 10 to maybe even 20 times that amount today, to put this system in place. And it was a total bust. It didn't work at all, mostly because the Vietnamese figured out almost immediately what was going on, and they spoofed it. I mean, they would, for instance, they would hang buckets of urine sort of hundreds of miles or dozens of miles away somewhere else in the jungle for the computer to detect and say that was a indicated presence of the enemy. Or they would run buffalo up and down the road to, you know, which would sound like a truck convoy to the sensors, and that would, you know, the buffalo would duly be bombed. And then anyway, it just didn't work. But the technology and the whole idea stayed with us, even after they'd come back. You know, Vietnam was long gone. And as I show in the book, this kind of attitude and a lot of the same technology was deployed again and again to the cost of, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars to you and me. And really the same mindset is in our drone warfare.
Well, you also talk about, in that war, they began to speak about high-value targets, and today this concept of high-value targets, actually assassinating humans, has taken over. Rather than attacking things like buildings and structures, it seems they get obsessed, even when they had a deck of playing cards when it came to Iraq.
Right.
With various Iraqis, they plan to kill, as if killing those individuals would eliminate the movement or their insurgency. Perhaps you comment on that.
Yeah, absolutely. It's this whole idea that, you know, the enemy is this sort of static thing, like a sort of static machine, and you can, by removing key bits, you can, you know, get your way and the enemy will collapse. So they did, as you mentioned, it used to be buildings and, you know, fuel tanks or something, which is what they pursued in Vietnam and in World War II. Now, and, you know, this really started with the Iraq wars, the idea is it could be people, that you take out that there's a key guy on the other side. If you get rid of him and maybe key guys, then victory is yours. So, in as you mentioned, they've tried to kill Saddam in both, you know, in 1991 and in 2003 during the invasion, and failed for reasons of, you know, because the technology, as I said, doesn't work so good. And, you know, Saddam took care. He used to drive around in a taxi so they couldn't spot him. And it's really got into full force now with the, you know, so-called war on terror, you know, where they've been obsessed with, you know, taking out the, you know, the head of Al-Qaeda. Well, obviously, you know, Osama bin Laden, or the number two or the number three or the head of operations. You know, they invest them all with these titles like it's, you know, the IBM Corporation or something. And that hasn't worked. And in fact, in Kill Chain, in my book, I show that there was actually one, they've only actually taken one serious look to see if it's working. They just generally proceed on the assumption. That was in Iraq, where someone looked at a list of 200 insurgent leaders that they'd killed and then looked to see if this had done anyone any good from, you know, from the U.S. point of view. And it turned out that it was quite the opposite. Actually, after killing each of these guys, attacks in those areas on Americans went up by about 40% immediately. So it wasn't, you know, we know, or they could know, and they have the information to show it doesn't work. But that is still our principal strategy, and that's what they're trying to do with ISIS, with no particular success.
If one looks back at 2001 and the size of the Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan, and only in Afghanistan, and the Taliban, one sees to think that the problem metastasized with American attacks, and other than bringing tremendous profits to the Lockheed Martin and our armaments industry, which may have been the main goal after all, this war has been a tremendous failure.
Yeah, totally. Exactly so. I mean, you know, as you said, in 2001, I mean, Al-Qaeda were a bunch of, you know, it was a small group basically hiding out in caves and a few apartments, caves in Afghanistan, a few apartments in Karachi. And now, you know, Al-Qaeda really controls a huge chunk of Iraq, a huge chunk of Syria. They just, I mean, when I say Al-Qaeda, I'm lumping in ISIS because it's really all the same thing by now. And a huge chunk of, you know, Libya, they're just taking control of the Libyan water supply. I mean, who's winning this war? So just, if I were, you know, sitting in the White House or the Pentagon, I'd be thinking maybe it's time to take a new look on the way we're doing things.
Well, they seem to be spreading it to the United States. We heard this morning that the FBI has contracted with 30 private contractors to fly drones over 30 U.S. cities.
I know, it's completely...
And police departments and sheriff's departments around the country are getting into it as well. As if, I mean, it's very high tech and it's very romantic, you know, it puts them up with the big boys. But what this does to our civil liberties and our threats to what's left of them remains to be seen. Doesn't seem to be any stop to that.
Right. Well, really what you're seeing is the Association of Unmanned Vehicle Systems, which is the drone lobby at work, because it's pretty stupid to have these drones circling. If you want to, I mean, leaving aside whether they should be spying on us anyway, which of course is no, but the idea that a drone is the sensible way to do it is really pretty silly. I mean, I can give you an example. A few years ago, the drone lobby got the Congress, you know, tame Congress, to give them pots of money to buy drones for the Border Patrol. So they bought, you know, duly bought a number of Reaper drones, and they flew up and down the border, Mexican border, and did apprehend a number of people crossing, you know, surreptitiously, migrants and people carrying drugs. But at the same time, some subversive character rented a Cessna plane, little two-man, very cheap two-man plane, and had that patrol the border with just a two-man crew, one of whom had a, you know, had binoculars and an infrared scope for night vision, and they caught far more people crossing surreptitiously at about a 30th the cost. So it's, you know, as you said, you hit the key word. It's romantic. It sounds great, high tech. You know, we're going to police for terrorists. You know, and you know, crush civil liberties in the process. You know, with all our whiz bang technology. But it, you know, the whiz bang technology doesn't work so good, really. And you know, it's very insidious in every way.
One of the more I hate to use the word entertaining, but certainly engrossing. At parts of your book or your description of two operations, one virtual and one real. One was Operation Anaconda, which was conducted in Afghanistan using all the high-tech operations, and then the Millennial Challenge 2002, the most elaborate war game ever staged. Perhaps you could tell us about them.
Sure.
Reading them, it's a real page turner. It's difficult to believe all this was happening, but the way you describe it, it's very visual. So,
okay. Well, I'll try to do it briefly. First of all, the virtual exercise, which is operation, which was in 2002, the Pentagon decided, and particularly Donald Rumsfeld, to show off, you know, the revolution of military affairs we were discussing earlier, and to show how brilliantly it worked. And I was obviously, they planned the largest war game in history. I mean, it was cost $250 million with thousands of troops involved, as well as, you know, huge computers and processing. And it was basically the idea of the game was going to be the U.S. confronting a sort of bin Laden figure who'd seized control of territory in the Arabian Gulf. And to play the part of the enemy, they hired this former Marine general, a guy called Paul Van Riper, who was a pretty feisty character, and he was the red team commander. Well, it all went wrong because Van Riper, you know, figured out very quickly how to deal with all this high-tech business. And the U.S. side was principally going to be a huge naval fleet. And Van Riper sank most of the U.S. Navy on the first day. He utterly outmaneuvered them. They'd cut his communications links, thinking that would skewer him, his phone links, so he'd have to go on the radio, which they could listen to. But instead, he simply had said he was using the mosques to people at the call to prayer to communicate messages to his followers, and sending messages around by motorbike and things like that. He utterly screwed them, and they reacted not by saying, oops, maybe we're doing it wrong, but by saying, okay, time out, and they tell Van Riper, okay, we're restarting the game, we're refloating the U.S. Navy. You're not allowed to do any of the clever things that you were doing to, you know, to defeat us. And so they went on, you know, and won the game. Typical of the military, you know, they were shown to be, you know, getting it completely wrong, and they just pretended it hadn't happened. The second one was, you know, when the fighting got real, when they'd invaded, it was actually around the same time, they'd invaded Afghanistan, as you know, and actually there was a Taliban commander who'd been trying to surrender. He intended to surrender, and he was engaged in talks through tribal elders, but they'd heard that he was holed up in a valley, a remote valley, the Shoei Kot Valley in eastern Afghanistan, and they planned this huge operation, Operation Anaconda, to get him, and they thought they could maybe capture bin Laden and, anyway, the big, you know, other big, you know, high-value targets. And it turned into a complete bust. One of the things that went tragically wrong was special forces decided to occupy a mountaintop in this valley. There was a mountain in the middle, and they were going to occupy the top of this mountain, which would be give them a good place to watch, you know, to survey things. But it turned out the enemy had the same idea, so they were already there. The high-tech stuff for reconnoitering didn't work, didn't show them the enemy were there. They landed, ran into an ambush. Quite a few were killed. Seven were killed. Many more wounded. And they were trying to run that part of the battle from an island in the middle of the Arabian Gulf, 1,000 miles away, because they said, our drone technology can show us everything that was going on, which it certainly did not. So it really illustrated once again how you know, how this thing really, even militarily, doesn't help you very much. And as we could, in the meantime, inflicts terrible harm on a lot of people down below who don't deserve it.
Well, speaking of what that term collateral damage, you write about how there was kind of an agreement that up to 30 people could be killed, civilians could be killed in one of these attacks, but if more than 30 were to be killed, permission had to come from Donald Rumsfeld or President Bush.
Right. But, it's incredible, isn't it? Well, this was in the Iraq invasion, and they were, you know, conducting this sort of basic, you know, assassination campaign by bombing, trying to kill Saddam and his henchmen, and they were killing a lot of civilians. But so a rule came down that it was up to 29 or less. If you were figured in your planning that you were going to kill, you know, 29 or fewer civilians, that was okay. You could just go ahead and blow them away if that was the case, and no one minded. If it was going to be 30 or more, you had to go up the line to Donald Rumsfeld or Bush, and these two monsters would say, you know, oh, that's okay. In fact, they did say that's okay, because in no case, when people submitted this request, was permission refused. And every time they said, fine, go ahead, kill them. So that's what's happened then. You know, now Obama said, well, we're going to be stricter, and, you know, you have to be almost certain, this was announced, almost certain that you're not going to kill any civilians in a drone strike. But actually, the CIA got a secret waiver. They said, well, it's actually okay. You can kill a few civilians. You know, there was a secret authorization for the CIA to kill civilians if they felt they had to. So obviously I want people to read the book, but I really want people to understand the reality of what's been going on and why it's been going on.
Well, you see the machismo. You have General Ricardo Sanchez, who's the overall commander in Iraq, quoting George Bush, John Wayne in the White House, saying, kick ass, explained the president. If somebody tries to stop the march to democracy, we will seek them out and kill them. We must be tougher than hell. There's a series of moments, and this is one of them. Our wills be tested, but we are resolute. Stay strong. Stay the course. Kill them. Prevail. We're going to wipe them out. We are not blinking. Extraordinary.
That meeting, that conversation I describe as relayed by General Ricardo Sanchez, who was the Iraq commander at the time, who, you know, described this. It wasn't just Bush, though. It was like even, you know, Colin Powell, who sort of liberals like to say, or, you know, moderate, you know, center, I don't know what you call them. Anyway, a lot of people like to say he was the moderate. He was trying to stop all this. And he's joining in, too, making the same sort of fatuous, you know, chest-thumping remarks. But they were all like that. Rumsfeld, too. You know, people really have to understand how, you know, the reality of what. They try and present this all as so precise and considered, and it's not. It's these sort of idiots using this technology, which the people outside are told are completely misled about.
And continuing to use it, and unlike at least Britain went through the routine of investigating Britain's role getting into the Iraq War, there's been a total lack of effort on the part of the Democrats, not to mention Republicans, starting with Obama coming into the White House and Nancy Pelosi, and the fact that in 2006, Congress became a Democratic-controlled Congress on the basis of an anti-war vote. And that's how Obama got elected. And yet immediately they decided that they had to look forward and not backward. Extraordinary. And there was no outrage on the part of the public.
Right. It's actually very, very dispiriting how dissent, you know, opposition totally has been crushed, has been sort of vaporized. No one raises a peep. I mean, throughout the book is a phrase I realized I was looking at the other day. I repeat a lot of times every time some weapon's been shown not to work or the war game I describe, I said it didn't make any difference. You know, the facts of the matter are laid out again and again and again, apparent for all to see, and it doesn't make any difference. And, you know, the people know. I mean, people understand broadly, as you said, in 2006, You know, there was the Democrats won because on an anti-war vote. Obama won the presidency as an anti-war candidate. He beat Clinton because he'd made one speech in Chicago saying not to attack Iraq, and she'd voted for it. I mean, he quickly changed his tune. You know, the vote didn't make any difference. It's people broadly understand, but why I wrote the book really was that people actually understand a bit more of what's being done in their name. Maybe, I mean, one would like it to generate a little bit of outrage, and people maybe could ask a few questions next time they're being marched to the polls to vote.
And with also the Republicans who are beating war drums in terms of Iran, it's like Lindsey Graham, these guys run around the world calling for more U.S. aggression, more extension of U.S. power. The neocons are at it again.
It's very scary. I've been writing about this in Harper's. You know, look at the way they've regenerated the Cold War over Ukraine. And it's really, they say they're at war in the Middle East. In fact, you know, they're losing the war. If you look at it, as I said earlier, that fact doesn't make any difference. They just want to, if you say why it's happening, I think it's all about the money. Just keep the money flowing. And, you know, the national security state is a great way to do that. All this Lindsey Graham and all these other people. I wouldn't hold out too much hope for Hillary Clinton either. I mean, she has a sterling record of warmongering too. So it's a bleak scene all around, but I try and be entertaining about it in the book in places.
Well, and you're well placed at Harper's, a venerable magazine, one of the few centers or sources of material in the American media that doesn't turn one's stomach.
Well, I'm glad to hear it. We do our best. We aim to. I certainly aim to turn the stomachs of some people in Washington. And I'm glad to say, in my last piece, I aroused the wrath of Citigroup, the nefarious bunch of admitted criminals. This huge bank. I wrote about them, and they wrote in whining, but they couldn't actually find a single error of fact, I was pleased to say. So, yeah, it's good to annoy them.
Well, that doesn't usually stand in your way, and you are continuing the line of your great father, Claude Colbert, who is one of the most distinguished journalists writing in the English language. Andrew, I'm so happy to have had you as our guest today. Sorry for the technological glitches.
Well, I think we overcame the NSA.
Yes,
I think we overcame.
Very good. So again, thanks so much for being our guest today on Takes on the World, and look forward to your next articles in Harper's.
Okay, Jeffrey. Thank you. Great to be with you.